Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT, and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Hello, hello again, my wonderful, wonderful audience. I have with me today Dr. Elizabeth Lee Vliet, V-L-I-E-T. She's an MD, a physician, a marvelous doctor, a force in the COVID-19 doctors movement to bring sanity, freedom, responsibility to what's going on today in the world of COVID-19. This is the Dr. Vliet's second Dr. Peter Breggin Hour, and she's also done a short video with me and is rapidly becoming my most frequent guest. She's a fountain of information, and she works very closely with this wonderful medical association, the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons. And it's a group that I want to get more involved with over time, and a very good group for any doctors out there who would like to find a medical association that actually believes in freedom and responsibility in the patient-doctor relationship. Today, I want to have Dr. Vliet tell us something more about the hearings that have been going on. And she has been very active in helping put them together and been in on this from the beginning with Congressman Johnson, who is holding the hearings. And we've had two sets now. One of them is with Dr. McCullough, who is on my show very, very recently, again, for the first time. We will also talk about the subject of how do you take care of yourself so you don't get COVID-19? What do you do to prevent and protect? So I'm going to just open up now to Dr. Vliet and start anywhere you like and then get around to telling us about the congressional hearings.
That sounds great. And thank you again for having me, Dr. Breggin. I really have enjoyed working with you on all of this. And I think it's critically important information. You know, as we begin, soon are looking at a whole year has gone by with suffering under the restrictions and restraints, economic loss, loss of lives that we've experienced with the coronavirus pandemic, with COVID-19 illness. I really want your listeners to know that we simply cannot keep going forward living locked down and in fear, terrified that we may die of this virus, when in fact it's a very treatable virus. There, we have had early outpatient prescription medicines that have been saving lives all year, and yet people have not heard much about it. And so I thank you for giving me an opportunity to reach a broader audience about the fact that we do have life-saving treatments. We have effective treatments that are old generic medicines doctors use every single day of our medical career, and they work in the right combination and right doses and right timing with COVID. And it's just been absolutely tragic in my mind that, and unconscionable, that these options and these approaches have been so suppressed and so prevented from widespread use by government bureaucrats, by political and financial agendas. And that really leads into the purpose for the hearings in the Senate. Senator Ron Johnson from Wisconsin actually reached out and called me out of the blue the first few days of April after he heard an interview that I did on COVID and hydroxychloroquine and early treatment for a radio show in Milwaukee at the end of March. And all of a sudden, I get this phone call from Senator Ron Johnson saying, I'm chairman of the Senate Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee, and I'm trying to find out what's going on, that we've got 75 million doses of hydroxychloroquine in the national stockpile, and it's not being distributed. What's happening? So I told him. And from that moment on, we've worked closely together. I've worked with him. I've worked with his staff and our organization, the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons, have worked hard to get him information that he needed. He's gotten petitions that we've done. He's gotten those sent to the president and Mark Meadows and the FDA and NIH and the Secretary of Health and Human Services. And he really was encountering the same roadblocks we as physicians were encountering. And that has led to him holding these Senate oversight hearings, one on November 19th, which I believe you have put up on your website, and one on December the 8th. And these hearings are on the Senate website, but they are also posted on Dr. Bregan's website. They're also posted on my medical website, which is vivelifecenter.com. And I have a lot of resources of articles I've written, interviews I've done, interviews that other people have done, and other articles and some of the protocols in other countries. All of that's on my website. So people have a resource to go to. And Dr. Bregan, I know you have done a phenomenal job creating a coronavirus COVID resource base on your website as well. So Senator Johnson's hearings have been bringing in some of the top experts in the world who are treating COVID patients every day. And if you look at the combined number of patients, COVID patients, that the 9 experts Senator Johnson called for his 2 hearings, we are looking at over 5,000 to 7,000 COVID patients that the group of experts that testified at Senator Johnson's request have personally treated. The one expert that the Democrat minority leader called to testify in the first hearing is the dean of Brown School of Public Health, admitted he has treated 0 COVID patients. And he had his mind made up against the data being presented by the experts that I'm working with who have treated patients. He had his mind made up and tweeted about it before the first hearing. So when you look at Dr. Jha's Twitter thread and all of the negative comments that he has made, he actually called Dr. McCullough, Dr. Risch, and Dr. Fareed snake oil salesmen. That is one of the most despicable, unprofessional comments I have ever heard a fellow physician say in public about people who have the stellar careers, the published medical articles, the citations in the National Library of Medicine, and the track record of thousands of patients treated overall. Dr. McCullough is not only a cardiologist, served on FDA task force, he has also published 1,000 peer-reviewed medical journals and has 500 citations in the literature and has treated several hundred COVID patients. For the dean of public health at Brown to call Dr. McCullough a snake oil salesman is absolutely unconscionable and despicable. And I think your listeners should be writing letters to the Brown School of Public Health and complaining about such unprofessional behavior. But in addition to that,
I'm smiling. It would be an endless task.
Well, I think it's needed. This person has absolutely perpetrated lies to the American public, and is continuing to do so in very damaging ways. And he is risking people's lives with his misinformation. Yeah. And that's the bottom line.
That's right.
I think we need to absolutely write letters complaining about that. Physicians have a duty to present responsible information. And that is what our team of experts did. And I encourage your listeners to go and listen to those hearings, because that is the most exciting, uplifting information from the six experts, especially who just testified on December 8th. If you want hope and help for COVID as a Christmas gift, go and spend the 2 hours to listen to all of the testimony and all of the successes that are coming out of the data. And Dr. Pierre Corey, in this last hearing, had an impassioned, powerful testimony, and he is pleading with the NIH to look at the randomized clinical trials that he personally has collated and put together in a published paper for the success of ivermectin in treating COVID, both prophylaxis and treatment. It is absolutely the worst situation in my entire lifetime, much less my career in medicine, that we have seen such massive suppression of incredibly sound, reliable, randomized clinical trials and observational studies covering thousands of patients. We're close to 200 studies showing the success of hydroxychloroquine, azithromycin, doxycycline, ivermectin, all of these antiviral, anti-infective medicines that are widely available, inexpensive, and doctors know how to use, and they have a wide safety record. Those are available now, and we can serve patients with telemedicine if their doctors don't wish to treat them. But those hearings...
Dr. Lee, tell people where they can find the telemedicine docs.
The telemedicine doctors are listed in three resources. One list is on the AAPS website, which is aapsonline.org. Another resource is frontlinemds.com. And another is speakwithanmd.com. And those are low cost, quick, responsive telemedicine options for people who have symptoms of COVID and want rapid, early treatment at home.
One point that I would emphasize for people is that these medicines are all safe. And those of you who know me at all know that I'm not protective of medication. I think the less the better. And in psychiatry, that means none at all, if at all possible. And these meds, I've checked them out. They are incredibly safe. So the question is, why would a man like that fella at the conference, at the first hearing, you know, why would he be cursing out his fellow physicians for suggesting a medication that whole countries have been using, that is over the counter in many places, that is related to countries that have the lower death rates? They're using these medicines. And the only explanation I can come up with, or I would say the nicest explanation I can come up with, is greed. That the greed of the drug companies for expensive drugs and for vaccines, and also the power of these companies and people like Bill Gates. But then it even has a malicious aspect to it. I mean, it's like they're trying to injure America. And America is really, you know, the last bastion of liberty. And a lot of these people are definitely not on the side of America's liberty. So I'll just leave it at that. By the way, I'm almost finished with a brand new book that's going to come out on this. Oh, God, it's been a trial. It's just emotionally confronting so much evil has been a trial.
Well, it is. It absolutely is. And when you look at the broader agenda, first of all, Dr. Jha did not disclose at the first hearing that he had research support from Gilead, the maker of remdesivir, and that is public information. That's not just opinion. And so there are many of the experts at NIH. In fact, in an editorial I wrote in the spring, it's publicly available information on the NIH website, the panelists on the expert NIH panel recommending treatment, nine of them had financial support from Gilead, the maker of remdesivir. And essentially, they had a financial conflict of interest that was not disclosed to the public. And they were recommending against hydroxychloroquine, which had reams more studies and successes around the world. And they were recommending remdesivir, which at that time was an experimental drug, that they hadn't even finished one clinical trial at that point.
Well, they had to actually abort a trial for Ebola because of the several drugs being put on trial. More patients were dying on remdesivir. They thought that it was actually killing patients. So it's so bizarre. It's so bizarre what's going on.
That's right. Well, it's clearly an effort to stake out financial turf in the wealthy countries, because the orchestrated, if you look at the countries around the world where hydroxychloroquine is prohibited or suppressed from being used, and ivermectin as well, they are the wealthy Western countries.
Yeah.
And if you, that are top vaccine markets, and the vaccines stand to be a multi-billion dollar market. Some have projected perhaps $1 trillion market. And so that is a huge financial agenda. The other agenda clearly has been a political one. If you look at where the lockdowns are the most draconian and where elderly people were with testing positive for COVID were required by their governor to be put back in nursing homes instead of going to the hospital, those were Democrat-led states, and it clearly was an effort to control the population, controlling everyone instead of protecting the vulnerable. So our entire strategy was aimed at locking down the economy in a presidential election year. I think the guidance given to President Trump by Dr. Fauci has been contradictory, it's been ineffective, it's not stopped the spread of the virus. Look at the fact that we are seeing the hospitalizations in some areas on the rise again. So,
and it wasn't science.
And it was not based in science. I really find it nauseating that
yes.
The left continues to talk about, well, we are basing everything in science. That's total garbage. We have no randomized clinical trials whatsoever that have ever shown that wearing masks all the time for everyone, including healthy people, stops the spread of a virus. They don't exist. And yet all of these control freaks are saying wear your mask all the time. I mean, Governor Newsom so ridiculously even said you have to wear the mask in between bites in a restaurant. Of course, he doesn't. Apparently, he's immune to the virus and he doesn't have to follow his own rules, which is typical of the Democrats and the left. It's always about the rules for thee, but not for me. And I think the whole, there's been the political agenda to disrupt America in an election year and damage the economy and weaken us. And China's had influence in that as well as releasing the virus on the world. But also, there's been the massive financial agenda. There is no money to be made by hospitals, drug companies, or government agencies. If you treat people in the outpatient setting, at home, with their loved ones, with cheap generic medicines that cost probably $20 for a course of treatment.
Yeah. Well, that's well put. I'm so glad you're being direct and honest about all that. should we move on and talk more specifically in a way that my wonderful audience can just simply understand what they can do to protect themselves against the virus, which we both agree can certainly be devastating to older people. And to people who are ill, and rarely to younger people, never to children, basically. What age groups do you think should be looking more at preventive medicine? And just talk about it in general, and I'll sit back.
Okay. Well, feel free to jump in with questions.
Well, I'm also on my end, folks. You may be hearing a kind of garbled sound that's coming out of my mic. On my end. So I'm going to especially just let Dr. Lee talk about this. And I'm going to sit back.
Okay. The first of all, you ask what age groups should focus on prevention. I'm going to say, Dr. Bragan, every age group.
That's what I thought you were going to say. And you're right.
All of the things that we can do to stay as healthy as possible. And one of my mentors said many years ago, my goal is to die as young as possible, as late as possible. And so we want to do whatever age we are, there are always things we can do to stay and improve, stay healthy and improve our health. And I mean, I still have to do those things myself if I want to stay out of the hospital and if I want to not have to take a lot of medicine. So we'll talk about, in general, what some of those foundations are. But the other thing I want to specifically say that concerned me greatly, a friend sent me an email this morning and said that Secretary of Health and Human Services, Alec Azar, was interviewed on one of the mainstream stations today. I think it was ABC. And he was asked the question, what should people do in the meantime while we wait for a vaccine? And his answer, I think, was not very satisfactory. He simply said, wash your hands, quarantine if you have symptoms, wear your mask, social distance, all the things that really have been mediocre at best in trying to reduce the spread and haven't fully succeeded. What I wish he would have thought to say is that while we wait for a vaccine, there is early home treatment. And early home treatment is, you can read about it in the COVID patient guide that I helped write and edit and put together with Dr. McCullough and Dr. Orient from AAPS, and we make it available free. So while you're waiting for a vaccine, and we can talk about what some of the unanswered questions about vaccines are, but while you're waiting for the vaccine, go print the patient guide and read about your options. It gives you hope. It gives you help. It tells you what to do and how to find the resources. And that's available free, www.covidpatientguide.com. So that's step one. Step two, while you're waiting, is clean up your diet. Don't make your diet a fuel for the COVID virus, the SARS-CoV-2 coronavirus illness of COVID-19. That virus feeds on sugars and sweets and carbs and alcohol, simple carbs and alcohol. Don't give it the fuel it needs to spread like wildfire in your body. Eat whole fresh foods, eat more fruits and vegetables, whole fruits, and cut out some of the highly processed foods that are high in salt and fat and simple sugars. Cut down the sweets in your diet. Don't drink alcohol every day if you want alcohol for a special occasion. Alcohol in moderation is not a problem, but when you have several drinks every day, you're essentially decreasing your immune response and you're making your body a better target for the virus. So don't do it. Don't eat ice cream all day, every day, or don't drink soft drinks all day, every day, which I see people doing. So I think looking at ways that we can make our body more resistant to all kinds of viruses, but especially the coronavirus, is particularly important. The other thing that you can do at home quickly now is fine-tune your vitamin regimen. We know for a fact that vitamin D levels above about 70 actually help reduce your risk of getting sick with coronavirus illness, COVID-19. So if your doctor doesn't check your vitamin D level, then at least make sure that you are taking extra vitamin D during the viral season, because it helps reduce your risk of viral illness. It improves your metabolism. It improves your immune system. It helps lift your mood and it helps improve your bones. So vitamin D actually is a hormone, not a vitamin. It's a critically important one. And that's something you can simply get started right away on your own. You don't need a prescription. Making sure that you take extra zinc during the viral season is another way that you can do a preventive medicine step. And what we recommend is about 50 milligrams elemental zinc on a daily basis. If your doctor checks your zinc blood level and finds that you're at the upper end of the target range, then you may only need 15 to 30 milligrams a day. But most people, and particularly older people, are zinc deficient, both because of their diet and because as people get older, the stomach acid is not quite as acidic and it doesn't absorb zinc and magnesium and calcium and iron as well as when we're younger. So zinc, vitamin D, extra vitamin C, and I tell my patients to take vitamin C with bioflavonoids to help as an immune booster, antioxidant, and actually that helps reduce your risk of viral illness as well. Make sure you have plenty of vitamin C. That's why your grandmother said, eat plenty of fruits because they're rich in vitamin C. So we've got those basics. And then I'm always recommending to my patients that they take a good multivitamin. And for those people that are concerned about access to prescription medications, we do have evidence, for example, that quercetin, which is an over-the-counter nutritional supplement, can help as a zinc ionophore to get zinc into our cells, and that has an antiviral effect. And you can take quercetin. Usually, most of the doctors that I'm in the coalition with on COVID-19, most of us are recommending anywhere from 500 milligrams twice a day up to maybe 1,000 milligrams twice a day for prevention. And that does seem to be effective for some people. So that's a, you do have to be aware that quercetin can interfere with thyroid medication. So for people taking thyroid, you have to be a little careful about that. But those are some.
How about quercetin? And does that go with the quercetin? Is that separate? No, but what about quercetin? Quercine?
I've not seen anything about a supplement with that spelling. Quercetin is Quercetin.
No, this is a little different. This is different.
Okay. That's just not one I've seen on any of the protocols that have been discussed in our group. So I can't comment on that particular
one. That's good. Okay.
And N-acetylcysteine is another one that a lot of the physicians in our consortium are recommending. And that is also available as an over-the-counter supplement. It's abbreviated NAC. And that recommendation is 600 milligrams a day. That's pretty typical recommendation. So I'm giving general educational guidelines.
Right.
When we as physicians work with individual patients, we tailor the doses to a patient after we've evaluated them. So for your listeners, I can tell you what the general guidelines are, and then they would discuss that with their own primary care physician or a telemedicine consultant that they may wish to discuss this with.
And now you do telemedicine yourself. You have a practice in Arizona, I believe.
Yes.
Do you do telemedicine with the folks?
Well, under the new guidelines that President Trump signed into effect during the national emergency, yes, all physicians are now able to do more telemedicine than we had been allowed to do state by state before the national emergency. And so I do telemedicine appointments for my established patients. In Arizona, if someone wishes to consult with me, there's a process that we need to go through legally in Arizona to deal with all the regulations about what the state of Arizona or the state of Texas requires physicians to do in order to establish a patient in our practice. There are forms to fill out and there's medical history that we get and their lab tests and things like that. The telemedicine, so that's a little different. The telemedicine services that have been companies set up to provide telemedicine services during the COVID pandemic are actually set up as companies that have physicians on their service licensed in all 50 states. Not that every physician is licensed in all 50 states, but that the company that has set up the telemedicine service has physicians in different states so that they cover all 50 states. And their procedures for establishing a patient may be a little simpler than what we have to go through, let's say in Arizona, for example. Mm-hmm. So I would just encourage your listeners to check the telemedicine resources, look at the list of practices in the United States who have signed up with AAPS as offering COVID-19 treatment services. And people can look at if they want to focus on only those practices that are covered under their insurance plan, there'll be options for that. My practice has never filed insurance because I have always said that I answer only to the patient and to God. And I don't sign contracts with insurance companies because I am not going to be their master. I am going to serve the patients and what the patients need. So for some people, my model doesn't work as well and they want to use their insurance plan, and that's fine. That's why I do a lot of educational programs to help people to know where the resources are.
Let's go back a little bit to to the prevention. I mean, weight seems to be a particular problem with this virus, isn't it? And does that mean I have to lose weight? I think it does. I've lost some already. I've lost probably almost 20 pounds since about a year or so ago. But
well, that's
2 years ago, maybe. That was Pam Popper's whipping me, my nutritionist on the air here.
Good. No, obesity is one of the biggest risk factors for being very sick with COVID-19. Obesity, diabetes, and lung disease, such as asthma, COPD, pulmonary fibrosis, and kidney disease. Those are the four top medical conditions that dramatically increase your risk of hospitalization and death with COVID. So getting diabetes under control, making sure that you stay hydrated, working to lose weight with healthy meal plans, and making sure, and I've written a book, Women, Weight, and Hormones, that still has, even though it came out a while ago, it actually is targeted to midlife and older women, and some of the specific aspects on all of the different hormone pathways, from the pancreas, thyroid, the ovarian hormones, the pituitary hormones, the stress hormones, thyroid hormones. And I talk about how all of the changes with aging push women towards gaining more weight and what you can do to lose weight in healthy ways. So looking at healthy weight loss options is a very important part of helping to prevent getting seriously ill with COVID. Exercise is not only helpful for weight loss and fat loss. You really want to focus on losing fat mass, not muscle mass. So exercise is extremely important to help you effectively lose body fat and reduce your risk of COVID illness. But exercise also helps boost your immune system. It helps oxygenate your lungs, which also helps compensate for having to wear a mask more for longer periods of the day. And exercise gets the blood flow going and helps rev up your engines. It's a mood lifter. It's an immune booster, and it helps you lose weight, and it just helps you feel good. So I can't emphasize enough how important exercise and healthy eating and weight loss are as preventive strategies that you can take. Now, what's interesting, Dr. Bregan, is that in all the research I've been doing and reading the older studies on hydroxychloroquine and all of its uses, it turns out hydroxychloroquine has been used to treat diabetics in the past and is already today in use in other countries to treat diabetic patients. So it's effective to help lower glucose and hemoglobin A1C in diabetics, and it helps reduce the risk of COVID. It treats arthritis, rheumatoid and lupus,
yes,
and malaria, and it has benefit against other viral illnesses. There have been studies showing that it reduces the incidence of seasonal flu. So hydroxychloroquine, while it's been demonized by the media and by those who are trying to prevent early treatment in favor of waiting until the expensive vaccines, hydroxychloroquine actually has many uses, and I've been using it in my practice for many different purposes, and it's quite effective and extremely safe. So I think people need reliable information on these medicines. Ivermectin, Dr. Corey just presented a wealth of important, critically important data at the December 8th Senate hearing about all of the studies showing how effective ivermectin has been in countries around the world and here in the U.S. in bringing down the incidence of people getting sick with COVID. but also he presented data about its effectiveness for prophylaxis. Both hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin are actually good prophylactic agents used in multiple countries, and they are agents used to treat the illness. All of this is widely available. It's just that you have to look for it because the media is not reporting it. I mean, these Senate hearings were not carried on any of the mainstream media outlets, which I think is just irresponsible and dangerous to ignore the expert testimony that was given in both of those hearings.
I think it's part of a very careful plan, you know, to just groom the nation to have to consume vaccines.
I think you're right.
It's hard to find any other. And they don't even have Remdesivir. The World Health Organization has now said it doesn't work. I told people it wasn't going to work way in advance. I mean, I knew that what its history was. I knew it wasn't going to show up to be anything good, and they'd have to cover up the adverse effects, which can be pretty bad. Yeah, well, that's such a situation, bad situation.
Remdesivir in the clinical trial that the NIH did this year, it had a 10% rate of causing acute respiratory failure and death, which was the condition it was supposed to treat. It had a 25% risk of liver damage. And I think the data, I think that they reported 23% risk of kidney damage. Those are horrendous odds and very serious side effects. You don't see anything even remotely close to that with hydroxychloroquine, remdesivir, azithromycin, doxycycline, corticosteroids. I mean, all of the medicines that we're using every day in the outpatient setting don't have any of those severe side effects and risk of death that remdesivir had.
And yeah, I was very struck by that from the beginning. It was just amazing. He had Fauci's promoting a toxin, literally a toxic drug that's never been shown to help a virus, to impede a virus. It may help them because some patients got worse on the remdesivir in earlier studies. So,
well, there's an oral version of remdesivir called favipiravir that is used in 30 countries, but the difference is that that medicine, which the FDA should have looked at to bring into the United States on a compassionate use basis, which the regulations would have allowed, but that is used in other countries within the first 2 to 3 days of symptoms, just like Tamiflu is used in this country for the flu. You can't wait with any viral illness. You cannot wait until late stage disease and expect a drug to work that is supposed to stop the virus from replicating. It's already replicated and it's already done so much of the damage.
Right.
And so the whole point of treating any viral illness, but especially COVID-19 illness, is to treat in the first 3 days of symptoms. And I'm trying to get my patients on treatment in the first 2 days of symptoms. I mean, they've got a day of symptoms. The next day I've told people in my practice, you call me and we will get you in and I'm going to get you started right away. And so by starting every patient I've treated, I've started within no later than the fifth day of symptoms, but usually by day three. And I've had no one have to go in the hospital, and I've had no deaths. Some have been very sick. And I am the first to say that this is not the same as the flu. If you go into the second stage of the inflammatory phase and the third stage of the blood clot stage, this coronavirus, COVID-19 illness, is not the same as the coronavirus that causes the common cold. You can be very sick and get critical fast. And I found that with several of my patients. I have three that I know for a fact would not have made it if we had not immediately instituted the full algorithm that Dr. McCullough talked about on your show just recently. And that meant doing the stage one medicines.
Right.
And then going to corticosteroids, either oral or inhaled or both. And then going to the anticoagulant medication and using oxygen therapy at home with a concentrator. And some of the patients needed to get up to 6 liters a minute at home. So it can be unpredictable. It can be very severe. And that's why I keep coming back to the point, do everything you can to stay as well as possible with all the preventive steps, exercise, eating right, the right supplements and vitamins, especially vitamin D, zinc, vitamin C, quercetin, perhaps, NAC, and a B complex vitamin is helpful. And then if you get symptoms, get on the phone right away and call one of the telemedicine. If your doctor is not going to treat you in the outpatient setting immediately, get on the phone and get lined up to start treatment quickly. And that's what gives you the best chance of staying out of the hospital and surviving the COVID-19 illness.
Do you think that some of these telemedicine doctors or all of them would be interested in calls asking about a preventive regimen for a particular person?
My understanding is that the telemedicine services are not set up to do the prophylactic prescription. So I can't speak to that other than the fact that many of the practices on the AAPS list, which is at aapsonline.org, that resource list of medical practices that are treating COVID patients are typically offering the prophylactic regimen. I know I'm offering it to all of my patients
that right.
want, because I think it's much safer an approach than to wait for the vaccine that has a lot of questions. And I said we'd come back to some of those, and we will. But the safety data on hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin for prophylaxis is so overwhelmingly strong that I think it is irresponsible to not offer that to patients. And I think actually history will judge physicians who have failed to do that as being negligent, because the data is so overwhelmingly strong that I sincerely believe that I would be negligent if I didn't make it available to my patients, knowing what I know.
Yeah, and you know, this was clear when I first started looking at the data way back in January, February, as soon as we heard about what was going on, it was so clear that's what was needed. And then we watched it get crushed. It was amazing.
Yes. And actually, to your point about it was clear back in February, it was actually clear to our NIH, Dr. Fauci, NIH, CDC, and FDA, going back to 2002, 2003, SARS-CoV-1, and they did the studies, the CDC and NIH did the studies in 2002, 2003, published in 2005, that showed unequivocally that hydroxychloroquine and chloroquine were potent antiviral agents in tissue culture, cell culture, and they stopped the virus from replicating, and they stopped the virus from attaching to the surface receptors, the ACE2 receptors of the cells. So it blocked the first two steps of the viral infection right at the beginning, two steps of the viral infection with SARS-CoV-1, and the SARS-CoV-2 that broke out in 2019, we now call the illness COVID-19 illness, that virus shared about 78-79% of its viral genome with the SARS-CoV-1. Right. So it was not rocket scientists figuring out that hydroxychloroquine worked against this one. These were studies going back 20 years.
Now that the folks don't know much about 2003, which also popped up in China, and people are still arguing whether it was from the Chinese labs or whether it was out of nature. There were only about 8,000 cases estimated in the world of SARS-CoV-1. And it had a higher death rate, actually had a higher death rate. Did they actually get to try hydroxychloroquine on those patients, or is this mostly Petri dish kind of stuff?
It was mostly cell culture studies at the time. Whether it was actually used clinically by doctors, I simply don't remember, because
we didn't have any cases in the U.S., so
it didn't last very long.
No, and I don't think, Bob, it was used much.
So I honestly don't know whether in other countries they were using it clinically, because the SARS-CoV-1 outbreak was so short lasting.
Yeah, I haven't seen anything about it. I wondered if you had. I haven't seen anything about its being used.
But they knew that it worked, and that was to your point about we had the data. And China started using hydroxychloroquine very quickly when it broke out in China in the fall of 2019. So China and Chinese doctors started using that because they knew, they found the studies from our CDC and NIH published in 2005. It was in the Journal of Virology, which was the NIH journal. So there's no excuse for anyone saying we didn't have the data.
We did. Well, China just doesn't get pushed around so much by drug companies as we do.
Well, true. they tend to do the pushing.
Yeah, they're in charge.
They are more in charge than we realize. Chinese physicians shared their success with hydroxychloroquine early in this pandemic.
Yes.
Doctors in South Korea who were seeing such rising numbers. And they also, the information was shared, China, South Korea, and India, so that India got on top of the SARS-CoV-2, COVID-19 illness very, very rapidly. And by March, the India Council of Medical Research had already published guidelines for prophylaxis of healthcare workers with hydroxychloroquine, 400 milligrams once a week, and zinc. They were prophylaxing the entire country of high-risk patients, and they were using it for treatment. And it's one of the reasons that India has a death rate 10 times lower than the United States, even though they have four times the population and far worse poverty and much less widespread infrastructure medically than we have available.
This is so important. I really want to emphasize it to people. There are countries like India that have freely used hydroxy, ramped up their production of it. They even sell it to other countries now. And they've got lower death rates. And, you know, so much was made that Trump must have done something wrong. Not Fauci, of course, but that Trump must have done something wrong because the U.S. had not among the lowest death rates. I don't think it had among the highest, but it didn't have among the best death rates. And in fact, the cause of that was they wouldn't let Trump use Trump's drug. They wouldn't let him use hydroxychloroquine. This is such an important point I haven't seen made on the air hardly at all, at all.
They refuse to make that point. I mean, that is an orchestrated suppression of the truth, because not only was the national stockpile donated, President Trump made arrangements with pharmaceutical companies to donate about 75 million doses of hydroxychloroquine. It's still sitting in the national stockpile, most of it, because very quickly those opposed to early treatment and cheap treatment and ending the pandemic quickly and keeping the death rate down. And there was mass opposition to that on the left. Those individuals, and we know who some of them are in the FDA and NIH, and I think you know who some of them are as well. But that plan to suppress hydroxychloroquine use, and now they are attacking ivermectin the same way because it's effective, that began right away in March. Mm-hmm. The restrictions at the FDA and that they imposed, and then there clearly was an orchestrated plan to disseminate the information to the state medical boards recommending against using hydroxychloroquine specifically at that time. And so we started seeing doctors threatened by the medical boards and pharmacists refusing to dispense it.
Yeah.
So it was, and that is, those are the reasons that we have such a dramatically higher death rate. And we are among the top countries in the world for deaths per million. If we're not in the top five, we're in the top 10.
Yeah. We have managed to finish an hour rather quickly from my viewpoint. We won't be able to go into any other topics other than, I think, let's wish everyone a happy new year. This will be most likely the first show of the new year. And it really has a lot of good news in it, folks. It also reminds us, and this is no fun, but it's so important, reminds us that we should lose weight if we need to. We should exercise. And by the way, even a little exercise is better than none. And then a little more is better and a little more. And moderate exercise is all a human being seems to need, as far as I can tell from what I've read. So just go out and enjoy your walking, enjoy your moderate exercise. I'm so glad Dr. Valide is giving the same message out that I am about eat more and more vegetables, more and more non-processed food, drink a lot of water, take good care of your health. It's a few basic things. Beyond that, do your best to find peace of mind, you know? Don't be ashamed to experiment with believing in God. Don't be ashamed of loving. Don't be ashamed of hugging and holding your friends close despite everything they're telling you in the coming year. We need each other. And in general, we need to be touching each other too, with reasonable restrictions with strangers and mobs and things like that. But using reasonable caution, we need to be together in the new year. I'm going to be fighting for freedom in the new year. I've got new stuff coming out. I'm involved in legal cases to try to stop the shutdowns. And I know Dr. Vliet's going to be out there just storming the walls, trying to get the good treatment programs out. So I think the thought I want to leave everybody with is another thing. If you can do something for folks in this coming year, get out of yourself. This darn virus and the shutdowns, they've caved us in on ourselves. Welcome the new year by reaching out to people, finding ways to help people. Nothing's better than for our health than helping other human beings.
Absolutely. And thank you again for having me, Dr. Bragan. The thing I would like to encourage everyone, there's hope, there's help. And just as the Christmas message was bringing light into the world, the light and the hope and the help comes from you taking charge of your health, reading what you can learn about the early treatment, and being proactive in seeking out the resources to get help. Don't just sit home and live in fear. That's so important. Fear suppresses your immune system. And I want to encourage everyone to focus on the positives, meditate, pray, exercise, eat right, and love those around you, and let's celebrate life, health, freedom, and the new year.
Thank you, Dr. Vliet.
You're becoming a dear friend without our ever having met. I think that's happening a lot in our new world.
That's true.
Bless you all, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.